Hello, Internet! Well, this is a bonus episode of the Assorted Calibers podcast. Just as I said, I'm on vacation. We're not going to have a show this week. Time off. Aaron goes and records an interview, and she interviews Cheryl Todd, the owner of AZ Firearms, Pot of Gold Estate Auctions, and Gun Freedom Radio. And I went, you know what, Aaron, this is a great interview, but it's way too long. What are we going to do with it? And Aaron said, hey, put it up as a bonus episode. Give the people something to listen to this week. So, you know what, I didn't even think about that. Aaron's way smarter than me. So, you know what, here you go. It's a little bit shorter than a usual episode of ACP, and it's a whole lot different than ACP. But you know what? Something to listen to, and I hope you enjoy it. So listen to Aaron and Cheryl Todd bring a little magic to you.
I am here today with one of the loveliest people I know. She is an absolutely classy lady, and if you are at all active in the gun rights movement, or if you listen to gun podcasts, you know who she is. She is Miss Cheryl Todd of Gun Freedom Radio.
You did that beautifully. Thank you so much, Miss Erin, for having me on today. I am so excited to be talking with you and your listeners today. And yes, Gun Freedom Radio. People rarely get the nuance, and you got it. Thank you.
I did. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad to hear that. I've been practicing. So you are quite accomplished. And just to hit the highlights, you run it's not really a podcast, is it? It's actually on FM radio.
Well, currently, as we sit here speaking, it is more in the podcast mode. I am in a season of transition, and it likely will come back as an actual televised and like an online televised show. But it'll always be stored podcast-like on our website, gunfreedomradio.com. So all the episodes, whether they're the freestanding hour-long videos that I'm doing currently, whether it's the full show format that's a two-hour multi-segment show, or whatever we decide to do when it becomes this televised piece, you will always be able to find that content on our website.
And what is that website?
GunFreedomRadio.com.
Okay. So in addition to all that, you are also a firearms activist. You are a Absolutely. Member of the DC Project, and mm-hmm. you are a regular speaker at Gun Rights Policy Conference.
I am, and I am beyond blessed to be able to serve in all of those capacities, because there are so many amazing people out there that have a longer history of activism than I do. And so I just feel that for me to be able to join those ranks of the people on whose shoulders I stand, it is just a tremendous honor and something that I do not take lightly, and causes me to work extra hard to be sure that I am very grounded in our Constitution and very grounded in the culture and the different shifts and changes that are going on, so that I can speak well to both our history and also to where we're going in the future.
Well, all of your experience certainly pays off. You are very eloquent every time I see you, but I'm going to throw you a curveball here. We aren't going to, at least on this episode, talk about your firearms activism. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're going to talk about something that I find really interesting, and it's not something we normally talk about, because not only do you and your husband own a gun shop in Arizona, but you also own an auction shop, and you auction off firearms. And I would really love to peek behind the curtain and find out what it's like to run a gun auction, and if there are any stories you can tell. Now, I'm going to start this off. You have that wonderful voice. Do you actually do the auctions yourself?
That is a great question. And the answer is no, because I can't do that, that cadence, that chant that they do. And I fear that if I tried, I would end up sounding like I had Tourette's and be spitting out accidentally some really naughty words. So we have hired a professional auctioneer. They were neighbors of ours, an entire family of auctioneers, if you can imagine such a thing. It started out the dad, the mom even is an auctioneer, but the son, Noah, has been with us for the longest. The dad was just getting ready to retire at the time that we opened potofgoldestate.com 14 or so years ago. And so he mentored Noah into the role and then pretty much exited very, very beautifully the way that they did it. And so now Noah, who is a young man, a newly married man, a new dad, he's around 30 years old, and he just does an amazing job with that whole, you know, humming a soul to just bring the fun and excitement to our auctions.
This reminds me of a little bit of a story. The first time I went to the women's luncheon at NRA, they had that auction, and when she was doing her bit, her spiel, whatever, she had a cadence that I couldn't quite place until I realized it matched up with Macarena.
Oh.
Thank you, sold.
That's awesome. And you know, I've never thought of that. I wonder if in their training, they kind of have like a song or something in their mind, because each auctioneer that comes in, because Noah always has a helper. We usually do 400 and some lots a night. Our auctions are on the first and third Tuesday of every month in the evening. We occasionally have an all day Saturday auction. And that's a long time to sing, quote unquote, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do that chant. And so Noah always has a helper and they trade off. And it's a good thing, I think, for the audience, you know, so you don't fall into that, you know, where you're just kind of like tone deaf after a while, to have it switched up. But each auctioneer definitely has their own style and their own. One guy that we've had in the past, he sounds like a horse race to me, you know, and is in the lead, and then is coming up from behind and sold. So,
well, there's a series of videos on YouTube. I don't remember the title, but essentially what they do is they take these cattle auctioneers, probably from Texas, and then they put hip hop or rap beats, not the lyrics, but just the music behind them. And it works surprisingly well.
I have got to check that out.
I will
forthwith, immediately.
I will dig up the link and send it to you.
I love it.
All right. So that's setting this aside. How does one get into the auction business, the firearm auction business? Just, you know, tell us some of the pitfalls and behind the scenes things we wouldn't normally know about.
Absolutely. So we also, I'm sure you'll talk about through the interview, we have a gun store and this auction, and they both started at the same time. And so one really relies on the other. They work synergistically together. So these two businesses, the gun store is a retail gun store. It has gunsmithing. It has, you know, retail sales of new and pre-owned firearms, ammo. The auction house is a little bit of everything. So yes, we do auction guns. We auction ammo. We auction reloading equipment, all these different things that are related to the firearms world. But we are an estate auction, which means really you're going to find the better things that you would find in a person's home. So whether it's a true estate where someone has passed away and the family needs to liquidate those items, or whether it's somebody that's downsizing and needs to liquidate some items, or whether it's just any citizen who just has extra stuff they're tired of storing, that sort of thing. We auction off not the, you know, the clothing in the closet, not the washer and dryer, not those things, but the antiques, the collectibles, the jewelry, the coins, the boats, the cars, you know, those kinds of things. And so it is a really fun and interesting business that you just never know what's going to walk in the door next. Now, you asked specifically about the firearm angle of this business. And I think that, you know, the most interesting thing is that we will have people call us from every single state across the nation. And what happens is that, you know, somebody inherits some firearms, and unless they have been really involved in the life of the person who collected these firearms, they very often have no idea what they have. Is something, you know, truly historic and vintage and collectible, or is it just a standard old hunting rifle? And so that education piece, that service piece, that really runs through the fabric of everything that we do. And sometimes when we are consulting with people, they realize that, oh, this item has much more sentimental value to our family than it does actual dollar amount on the auction block. And so in those ways, it's very rewarding because we've helped a family retain a piece of their history that can continue to be passed down through the generations. Something else that happens is that, especially neighboring California, we are in Arizona, a small town west of Phoenix, called Avondale, Arizona. And so the next state over to the west is California. And their laws keep changing out from under people. So one day, the item that a family owns is perfectly legal. The next day, some new law comes along. Nothing has changed about the family. Nothing has changed about the tool, the item itself, the firearm. But suddenly, whoever is in possession of it could possibly be breaking laws, possibly felony level laws. And so people will call us and ask us, you know, to please, you know, come and consult with them, or to please remove these items because they just don't, their family just doesn't have the ability to own them, not because they don't want them, not because they don't have that familial connection to them, but because they simply are no longer legally allowed to own them. So I think that that is one of the most interesting, impactful, and rewarding parts of our job. It's sad to us that, you know, if a family wants to keep something and it's just the fact that their laws changed, that we're, you know, now taking and setting this item on the auction block over in Arizona, which is perfectly legal because we have a federal firearms license. So as soon as we take possession of the item, we are able to move it to where it needs to go to hit the auction block. But that part, it's a little sad, but it's rewarding in the sense that we've been able to offer a service and ease the mind of the family.
Well, I am very impressed that you are willing to give up a sale in order to make sure that a family keeps something that's sentimental. That's a sign of character that is sadly lacking from a lot of gun stores these days.
Well, I appreciate that. And we experience that in so many ways. I mean, there's jewelry involved, you know, some grandmother's wedding ring, you know, to the next person, it's just a pretty ring. But to this family, it's part of their history. And I'm a sentimental person myself, and so I would never want to separate that family line, that line of history, for the matter of a few dollars.
Mm-hmm. So why would someone, not specifically with an estate, but just individual, that they've inherited some guns, why would they choose to auction them rather than just try and sell them to your gun store?
Oh my gosh, that's such a great question, and something that we spend quite a bit of our time consulting to tell people. So I, as a gun store owner, right, that's one hat that I wear. If you walk in and you say you want to sell me item X, well, I have to already factor in that, well, once I purchase this item, it might sit on my shelf for a year. So my money's tied up for a long time. I have to factor in that, once my gunsmith goes and does a run through, maybe it's got a broken spring, or maybe it's got a something, you know, that requires a little bit more time and money to get it truly in a sellable position. I have to factor those things in. I have to factor in how many of those do I already have in my inventory? And so that sets the price where we begin to negotiate back and forth what I'm comfortable spending and what the customer is comfortable, the client is comfortable accepting for that item. With the auction, they consign that piece. No money changes hands. I'm not tying up my money as a retailer or as an auction house. The other party, the client, they aren't receiving money immediately, but what then happens is when it does go to auction, every bidder is driving that price up rather than negotiating a price down. And it's such a powerful tool to get the most that your item is worth. And here's a tricky thing, though. My dad taught me this years ago. He said, what is something worth? What is the value of this, you know, fill in the blank? And, you know, of course your mind is like, well, you know, I can go to the books that set prices, or I can go to, you know, like the online sources and see what things have sold for in the past. And he said, no. An item is worth what someone else is willing to pay you for it today. And so newer items, pick your favorite Glock model, right? That's available anywhere. Well, they pretty much set the price. If you're going to buy a brand new one retail, that is what they have decided it's worth. Now, once it's been pre-owned and now it's a used item, that fluctuates a little bit. But the fact that there is a set standard out there, that's going to kind of give you a rough idea. But if you're talking about, you know, a Mauser from World War II, and maybe it has some provenance of who owned it, and, you know, maybe it's papered and was brought back over from the war, then it's a completely different thing. And that value is now truly what someone else is willing to pay for it. And it can go all over the map. And even though you might have one that's similar, that sold for X dollars a year ago, well, this is a whole different ballgame. And this is an emotionally based price system, based on history, based on the buyer and what they value it to be. And so it really is a fascinating business model when you think of it in those ways.
So perhaps the short version is, if it is just your regular Glock 19, you sell it to the store. But if it is somehow different, unique, has history, you really should auction that.
That is beautifully summarized, yes. And, you know, even with the Glock 19, this is something that, you know, when you're not in a business, you know, maybe you're someone who's just never been an entrepreneur, never been self-employed, it's really difficult for people to wrap their brain around, well, I just paid, I don't know, $459 for this thing. And I only had it for a few weeks and decided I didn't really like it. And now I want to either trade it in or I want to sell it outright. It is no longer worth $459. To a store that has to, again, make another profit on it. So that is a piece that is difficult for people to understand. It's like a car. The minute those tires hit the curb, driving off the lot, this brand spanky new, beautiful, it smells good car, the minute you drive it off the lot, it's worth half of what you paid for it. It's just the nature of retail and secondary market. And I'm not saying that the Glocks are half. I'm just saying that there is definitely, you're not going to gain more money than you paid, and you're not going to be able to sell it back for the same price. It's not like you can go in and return it type of value.
Well, one of the good things about firearms is that while they do depreciate, they don't depreciate as rapidly as cars.
Exactly. That is so very true. And, you know, some of the older stuff, we've actually seen over the course of the, you know, 14 years that we've been in business, would have been a pretty decent investment had you bought them, you know, 20 years ago. The some of the older stuff, the value has really gone up more than some other investments that you might have made. So it's an interesting business.
It really sounds interesting. And I figure we've got some listeners who are now going, hey, I should really get into the firearm auction business. So what are some of the pitfalls that you can encounter? What are some of the obstacles you had to overcome in growing Pot of Gold Auctions?
Well, I would say, and it's not firearm specific, because you'll need an FFL. You'll need your own firearms, federal firearms license, in order to have an auction, because you'll have to take possession of the items. They'll have to go on your books because you'll be storing them during that the time frame between taking in the consignment and then whenever your auction ends up taking place, and then you sign it out just like you would in the retail sense to the new owner using the federal form 4473 and all of those things. So it's very similar to having a retail business in those paperwork and paper trail type instances. But the tricky part of auction really is that what someone anticipates and hopes that their item is going to sell for and what it ends up actually realizing sometimes are very far apart. And it's a totally open process. There's no hidden anything. We even Facebook Live our auctions so people can watch in real time. Well, okay, my item sold for X dollars. And so if it's less than the X you had in your mind, it, you know, sometimes we have consigners that are, they're disappointed, they're frustrated. They understand logically, you know, but it's still, you know, they kind of always want to ask the question why. And there's very seldom an answer to the question why. But for every item that sells for less than what someone hoped, there's an item that was like, wow, what just happened right there? That thing went for off the charts. And when that happens, it is sometimes that newer Glock. And somebody just got caught up. One of the bidders just got caught up in the excitement of bidding and the competition of bidding. And sometimes they pay too much. And so then the conversation with the client that ended up being the successful bidder is, you know, maybe a little bit of buyer's remorse, you know, a little bit of, oh man, I didn't mean to bid that much. Is there anything we can do about that? And of course, the answer is no, we're sorry, but, you know, we're just a venue. You know, you made the decision to bid, and nobody's ever gotten, you know, nasty or anything like that. But you do feel a little bad for them that they're like, oh man, as they pull that credit card out, they're like, dang it, why did I let myself get caught up in that? But those things, when it's time to consign, sometimes there's a lot of emotion involved in a family, especially if there's been a life event that people have, or at least feel they have a lot less control over. It could be divorce. Sometimes people have had to liquidate their things in the settlement of a household in that way. Or, of course, a death in the family. There just tends to be naturally a lot of emotion that comes out. And so my husband, Danny, is usually on the front lines of going to people's homes and consulting with them and writing up the consignment forms and that sort of thing. And it's so interesting how it has turned out, because my degrees are in psychology. Mm. And I have spent a lot of time in, you know, facilitating Bible studies and being a worship leader at church. And so I have a rich training of interacting with people in emotional ways and emotional language, that sort of thing. He has not. And he's the one that's on this front line. And he is amazing at it. Like, absolutely amazing. He'll come home and tell me some of these stories. And I'm like, I am so proud of you. I like, that is beyond what I would have thought to say. And, but he just really can understand. He lost his mother to lupus when he was in his 20s, lost his dad about 10 years ago. And so he can really empathize. He's been married twice before me. And so he, I think, can really stand in another person's shoes and go, I, you know, nobody knows what it feels like because each person's life and pain and emotions are their own, but he can empathize in such a way, I think, that he can help walk them through it and not let them stay in that place and just say, man, I get that. But, you know, here's the benefit of unloading this physical stuff. I know sometimes it's hard and it feels wrong. And, you know, why did this have to happen? But here's the other side of it. And now what can you do that you're unburdened from these things and you've, you know, allowed another family to now enjoy them and those kinds of things. It's, you know, you just don't ordinarily think about that angle when you're just like, hey, I want to be a business owner, right?
Right.
And you end up being an emotional counselor and sometimes a spiritual counselor. It's a really interesting thing.
Huh. Yeah, that's not only interesting just in general, but the fact that you have the training and you aren't doing that sort of thing.
Well, we, of course, you know, point to God. We're spiritual people. We're Christian family. And so we point to God and we're like, he has the best sense of humor that he does things like this.
All right. So we know what Danny does for Pot of Gold Auctions, but other than being a very lovely figurehead, what else do you do for the store?
Well, at this point, 14 years in, and being a family-owned business and having mentored our only child, Cassie, into the role of manager of the auction house, I have pretty much relinquished any of the day-to-day responsibilities. My master's degree is psychologically based, but it is the master's of organizational leadership. Mm. So that's about culture, that's about relationship, that's about communication, whether it's person to person or business to business. And so I bring those things. It's even Cassie, our daughter, who's the manager, she is HR for the day-to-day stuff, but I would be sort of like an overarching manager and leader and guider of, well, where should the business go next? And how should we handle, you know, this particular, one of the interesting things with especially pre-owned items is how cyclical the market can be. So things that when we first opened our auction house were like hotcakes, like, you know, worth their weight in gold. Now you can barely sell those things. And so if we don't recognize the changes in buying behavior and the changes in collecting behavior and that sort of thing, then we're going to run right off the rails in a big hurry. And so my role really in all of our businesses is that kind of leader, guider, mentor position rather than down in the day-to-day, you know, doing the books and, you know, having those conversations that you have to have with staff members from time to time, or doing their annual review, that sort of thing. Cassie has really taken over that role for us.
So you brought it up, and I'm dying for an example. Please give me an example of one of those cyclical things which was hot then, and now you can't even move.
Oh, gosh. Well, the first thing that comes to mind anytime we have this conversation is depression glass, which I might have to explain the average listening audience. And Roseville pottery, which again, I will probably have to explain. So both of those items, Roseville pottery was just made during the Depression era in the 1920s and that sort of thing. Depression glass, similar thing. Some Depression glass, it was actually like a prize that you would find in your tub of oats, right? Your Quaker oats or your tub of dry laundry soap, that kind of thing. So it was used as a premium. And so people would collect these whole sets. Jewel tea was similar to that. If anybody knows what jewel tea is, it's a beautiful fall colored pattern that's on porcelain items. So depression glass comes in many different patterns, but it is made of glass, pressed glass. And Roseville pottery or jewel tea porcelain, those are, you know, ceramic items, porcelain items.
Are we talking plates? Are we talking decorative vases? What are we talking here?
Oh, very good question. So with depression glass, it's mostly stuff you would sit at your dinner table and serve food out of. But there were also some decorative vases and that sort of thing. With Roseville pottery, strictly decorative. It could be this huge jardiniere vase at that point, right? That you couldn't even wrap your arms around, that was set on a decorative pedestal in your foyer. Or it could be as small as, you know, just a little bud vase that you would set on your shelf. But lots of different patterns. So sometimes people collect patterns. Sometimes people just collect Roseville. Jewel tea is more towards the, you know, usable. It's teapots and it's, cups and saucers and things of that nature. And so those things back in the, whatever the date would be, 14 years ago, super hot, super collectible. You could barely afford it if you were just an average person. And now people just kind of pass them by when they come up at auction. And it's hard for me because I still have that affinity to, oh my gosh, I would have loved to have been able to afford that thing. And, you know, here it is coming through my auction. And this is so wonderful. You know? And it's like, it is still wonderful. It is still beautiful. It didn't get any less beautiful. But is the collecting audience aged out, I think. Another thing that happens very often to a collectible item is somebody will come along and reproduce it. Now, with the depression glass, particularly a real beautiful, creamy, milky green color called jadeite, Martha Stewart started reproducing that, and it killed the market because then people could just buy something brand new at a whim and not have to scour the, you know, because part of it, so much a part of collecting is the hunt, right? Scour the antique shops and go online and, you know, try to outbid somebody at the auction or the eBay site. And so it just kind of took the sport out of it, I think. And even Roseville started getting reproduced in China. And I mean, if you know Roseville pottery, at a glance across the room, you can tell what's, and I think I am not an art aficionado, but I think that if you are an art aficionado, it's kind of like that. It's like when you have perfect pitch and everything else just sounds like discordant noise if it isn't right on. And so Roseville pottery is like that. Once you know it, you can spot it and you're like, oh, that's garbage over there. versus, you know, the genuine item that has gone through the ages. And that is so much a part of when you're collecting an antique or something that's vintage, is imagining the stories it could tell if only it could. And then when there's this, you know, brand new piece that's trying to look like it, I don't know why that, again, necessarily makes it less exciting to own the original. It seems like it might make it even more exciting, but in the market, that is not how it works. It is just done.
Mm. Are there any firearms that are cyclical like that?
You know what? That is a question that I'm not sure I have a great answer for. And as I'm talking, I'm searching my mind and my memory. I feel like if something, the only way I think it impacts in that way is an item that people are excited about because it was just featured in a major blockbuster movie. Mm. We will see that when a John Wick comes out, or when a, a 007 movie comes out, or you know, James Bond, something like that, that's featured in a movie and people are like, I have to have that gun. It's because then it is more that emotional purchase. And then once that movie has kind of gone passé, then, you know, there's just not the same rush for it. But as far as, no, I don't think so. And somebody out there listening is probably shouting at the not the radio. What are we on? The internet. Shouting at the internet right now saying, yes, it does. And it's this item. But I truly can't think of it in the same terms as something like a depression glass.
Well, we have very vocal listeners, and I'm sure that if any of them know of a perfect example, they will leave a comment and let us know.
Yes. Yes. And I'll be happy to read those and update my mind.
So it sounds like you used to be the manager, and now your daughter has taken over that role, and that has left you free to pursue your activism. Would that be correct?
That is so correct. And just to take a step farther back, when we first opened the auction house, there were three people that did everything that now a staff of, it fluctuates, but generally around six people, eight people do. And truly, I did everything from bringing in the consignments, cleaning the item, describing the item online, photographing the item, you know, everything up to having that auctioneer do the chant. And so turning those things over to Cassie, and then she has now turned them over to staff so that she can be the manager. So yeah, that is so true. I have turned a lot of those things over, which is a wonderful thing and a rewarding thing. But it's sometimes difficult to delegate in those ways because you feel like, well, nobody's going to do it as well as I do. But I think that's the plus of having my daughter who grew up in this, and she truly understands who we are, what our methods are, the underlying mission of the business, which truly is knowledge, relationship, and service. Yeah, it's wonderful to have had somebody like her to pass things along to. And yes, now I do have that opportunity to serve in a different way through activism. And she's right by my side with that as well. So she is one busy little girl. Well, she's not a girl anymore. She's a mom of two and a wife of 10 years. So yeah, she's a busy young woman.
Wow. Thank you for coming on the show. I've had a great time talking to you. I will definitely have you back in the future so we can talk about your activism. I would love to hear about your activities with the DC Project and all of the other things you do.
Well, I appreciate that so much. I will be excited to come back anytime you ask, and I need to have you back on Gun Freedom Radio very soon. And thank you for letting me share with your listeners about our gun shop, azfirearms.com, our auction house, potofgoldestate.com, and of course, our radio show that is lockstep, hand in hand with the activist piece that I do, and that is gunfreedomradio.com.
So there you have it. That's a bonus episode of the Assorted Calibers podcast with Aaron Paulette interviewing Cheryl Todd. Thanks, Aaron, for bringing me that interview while I was on vacation. That was super nice of her, and it's super nice for all of you. So thank you all for listening. But a very special thanks to all of our listeners on Patreon. Speaking of Patreon, patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like your hilarious blooper reels, the ACB film tracks, and the ACB mag dump. And also, remember, rate us on Apple Podcasts. We need ratings. Evidently, it helps people find the show. More people to find the show, that makes us all happier. You like the show, help people find the show. And of course, also, tell your friends both online and off. Tell everyone you can. If you love this show, let them know you love this show. Come on, we're an approachable Second Amendment podcast. We are there for all that. So even your family and friends are like, I don't really like the fact that you have guns. They might like this show. Let them give it a try. What do you say? Thank you all, and we will have a regular episode of ACP. We're actually recording very shortly an ACP roundtable, so I think you'll enjoy that. And so you will hear from all of us very soon.